Love Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening. Happy Shabbat to one and all. Here we are this evening with James and Kirk. How are you guys?
Doing good.
Hey, JB.
I was going to just go straight back to one of the passages we had covered last week, but there are a number of posts in the chat room that I'd really like to speak to, and it's, you know, the first one is, any Russian bots in the room? And comrade, soon Mother Russia will rule your pathetic USA through Comrade Trump. Trump. You know, I've read some of the reaction of Trump's summit with Putin. And I have some reaction that I just want to share. The extent of the Russian meddling in the U.S. elections, should it have been coordinated by the government as opposed to just individual hackers, is really twofold. One is that someone from Russia appears to have hacked into the DNC's email servers, and they published some of Hillary's and other DNC big shots' emails. And what they demonstrated by revealing their emails is that the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, and Democrats in general are like religious leaders. They are complete and total hypocrites. They don't believe.
All it did was reveal their true nature.
Yeah. And my argument always is that if your emails expose you as a hypocrite, don't blame the person who revealed your emails. Look in the mirror.
Yeah.
You wrote them. And the second is they bought a bunch of Facebook ads, social media ads, and the lead among them, the most effective among them, was this caricature of the Christian Jesus and a caricature of the horned Christian Satan arm wrestling with Satan representing Hillary and Jesus representing Trump. And Satan says, you know, I'm gonna control America. I'm gonna take away your religious freedoms. And Jesus saying, not if I can help it. You know, and if you're stupid enough to get your news via social media, if you're stupid enough to believe a cartoon like that has value, then we are so pathetic that anybody with a good story could pull the wool over America's eyes. I have come to the conclusion that I do think there's a significant chance that Trump will be impeached. I think, for example, what he did in terms of the payoff to Stormy Daniels prior to the election, which is a very serious offense, that now that there is a recording of him talking about it with his former attorney, I think he's in pretty serious trouble with that. But the fact of the matter is that I am of the conviction that the entire Russian story has been made up, including the story of the Ukraine, for a singular purpose, the meddling in U.S. politics. Singular purpose. and that is America demands a boogeyman. The military complex of America, its spy network, requires a boogeyman. It has to be this threat out there that we all need to be defended from to maintain our freedoms, that we need these spy agencies to usurp our freedoms so that we can have our freedoms.
Maintain.
Yeah, we need to have the least free institution in America, the military, be the stalwart of freedom, these living contradictions, and the only way to justify their existence and these gargantuan expenditures is to have a boogeyman. Well, they're no boogeyman.
It's 1984. It doesn't matter who the enemy is as long as it mm-hmm. distracts people and keeps them angry.
Correct.
And something to direct their anger at. They're afraid. Now we can control them. They're not attacking us, and we can take away their freedom.
Well, China became more like the United States than the United States in terms of free enterprise. So China's not a boogeyman. Plus the fact China only has one pretend aircraft carrier. I'm not even sure it works. They're not projecting a force. And you look at Islamic terrorism. Sure, Islamic terrorism is a tremendous threat to the survival of the world. But all of the talking heads in government are afraid to even list Islam as a threat because that's not politically correct. So they can't use it. And global warming was a bust. And it's really hard to say that climate change is your great threat. They needed a threat. They needed something to justify NATO, to justify the military, to justify the spy apparatus, to justify the usurping of our freedoms. And so this whole story is a mess, all conceived for that purpose, being played for fools. Anyway, that's my take on it.
No, it's no different than any other war we've been into. I mean, think about it. Vietnam, Korea. Who the hell were we afraid of? World War II?
We what was going to happen in Vietnam that was going to be a threat to the United States? Tell me.
Yeah. Well, that was my question.
why did 57,000 Americans and millions of Vietnamese have to die to simply turn Vietnam over to the commies? Mm-hmm. Can you just tell me what we were so afraid of in Vietnam that was worth 57,000 American lives? Why did we sacrifice 35,000 American lives in North Korea? What? For what reason? Why did we sacrifice 1,000 lives for every life taken as a result of our stupidity in Pearl Harbor? Are we that bloodlust and bloodthirsty, vengeful? That the proper response to 3,000 dead is 300,000 dead?
No, more than that. That was just our losses. And I didn't even counting how many we killed.
Oh, no, millions.
Oh, no, that's just our losses. That's
100 million. 100 million people died in that war.
Yeah. You know? I just don't get it. And people rally around and salute the military as if it's something worthwhile and good. Goodness gracious. Kirk, you wanted to highlight a couple of the words that we found in Yeshaya 53:3. So let's read that again. We'll read 54:4 and then return to 53:5. And just as a way of background, the reason we're considering Yeshaya 53 now is specifically that the story of Abraham and Yishak's affirmation of the covenant with Yahweh was specifically designed to draw our attention to Yahweh's ultimate means to enable the benefits of the covenant, which is the fulfillment of Pesach by the Passover lamb, the fulfillment of matzah by his soul, and the fulfillment of Pesach, which enables us to be born into God's family so that he could enrich and empower us on Shavuot. That is the story, and it's primarily focused on the first act of that, which is the sacrifice of the Passover lamb. And one of the best presentations of the sacrifice of the Passover lamb, in fact, using terminology that is consistent with the Bavarshith account of Abraham and Yishak, his son, going to Mount Moriah, is Yeshaya 53. So we covered it briefly just to understand the fact that the verb used for how the radiant light and horns of the sacrificial lamb were caught in the thicket, that it was found also in Yashaya, and that was directed to us the first time. And now we're being more comprehensive. We look at the whole story, because in the story of Yashaya 53 are profound insights. And what's amazing is that it's probably the most often quoted prophetic book in Christianity. Statement within Christianity.
Yeah, amazing.
That this is the story of their Jebus. But with every word, Christianity is destroyed by what is revealed through the prophet Yashaya. So let's read the 50. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say as a preface to that, you know, what is so interesting, and you allude to this a little bit later in your commentary, you when you talk again about 22 and 88, Psalm 22 and Psalm 88,
right.
And then if you're going through Yashaya, and in particular 53, they so contradict everything about Christianity, and quite frankly, everything that is ignored in rabbinical Judaism. And it's so explicit and so exacting, and it also, to me, it instantly, I was sitting back thinking about the last week, and I was thinking, you know, it just absolutely destroys any concept that we need an eyewitness account. I'm not saying that it isn't nice that you got some historical stuff, and that it also doesn't contradict what Yahweh has said. But the simple fact of the matter, if you look through those three things plus 53 that we're covering now, you've got Yahweh telling us who Yosha is going to be, what he is, what he's about, and how he's going to fulfill these things. And then I'm not a translator like you and JB. Y'all write very well. But I can analyze these words, and it's amazing the depth of each one of these words and how much they are chosen and put together to describe Yosha. And when I was looking back on it, I can read this if you like, and then we'll analyze a couple of the words and just look at them closely, and y'all throw your comments, please. He said he was despised and viewed with contempt and therefore rejected by mankind. And the two words there, of course, for being viewed and despised and viewed with contempt is bizarre. Obviously, he came to his family, and he's hated today by every Christian. If you hate the Torah and you hate all those things, then you have to hate Yahweh.
Yeah, let me share something with you that I think is really profound here.
Okay.
During Yosha's 3 years where he was had received the set apart spirit, and he was in the midst of his teaching, and ultimately at the end of the 3 years fulfilling the promise of Pesach Van Sibukah, he was not despised by the whole world. He was despised by very few people. He wasn't despised by the rank and file people in Israel. The overwhelming preponderance of Israelis didn't despise him. In fact, they even acknowledged him. He certainly was not despised by the Romans. The Romans couldn't care less about him. He wasn't despised by anybody other than a handful of people that were trying to protect their religious power.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that he was despised by viewed with contempt by mankind, it's utterly ridiculous. That's not what occurred. So what are they talking about? If it didn't occur during those 3 years, what's the prophecy about?
From that point on.
It's obvious to me that you've now got the Christian Jesus being based on Dionysus, and the most popular religion in the world despises the fact that he represented Yahweh, despises the fact that he was a Yehudi, who's a Jew, despises the fact that he was Torah observant, despises the fact that he didn't celebrate Christmas and Easter, worship on Sunday. He was Torah observant. They despise the actual individual who fulfilled this promise. And now it's not a few people, it's the whole world. Christians, Muslims, secular humanists, the whole world. Jews, everyone. So it's these caricatures that have replaced the actual individual and the actual hatred that exists for Yosha as he was, Torah observant, a Jew. It drives them bonkers. Now, it's not just that they've replaced the truth with a lie. They hate the truth.
And they perpetuated it. They taught it.
Yes. Oh, man, that's the whole idea. You can't have Yosha have the Hebrew name. No. We've got to give him a anglicized Greek name. We're going to name him Jesus. You can't have him be the Messiah. Oh, heck no. We're going to call him the Christus. Come on. It is so pathetic.
Well, the truth is the greatest threat to their power and their control, so they heed it.
Right. As a man, well, you know, he also languished physical pain. By the way, if he suffered physical pain, how in the hell was he God? If he suffered anguish, how could he be God?
Well, you know,
sickness the word there, of course, God gets sick. My God doesn't get sick. I don't know about yours.
How could he get sick? How could he get sick?
All right. So you had another word or two to
talk about. I was just going to say, in the word that you're talking about, the sickness and affliction was choli, and of course that's disease and injury and grievous evil and so forth. But the one that was, the thing that was, I hate to say funny, because I don't mean to be funny, it's very sad, but it's ironic at least. And
it is.
It's from chalal, which is to become diseased and weak through prayer.
Yeah, that's
the one thing
that
all do. Bow our heads and close our eyes and go to the Lord in prayer.
You know, it's so amazing how even agnostics pray with their children, and how many people I've talked to that I've met recently I pray, and I've had, I prayed for my daughter, I prayed for my son. There was this terrible incident, and I made this deal with God. This was my prayer, and so that's my belief. And you go, okay, come on.
Doesn't he say somewhere he doesn't hear prayers of people who are not his family?
Yeah,
I think so.
He says the prayers of those
I'll say this.
Are covered with shit.
Before I came to know Yahweh, I had one prayer. I did ask God one thing, and it was one real simple thing. And I think this is something God would want. Is my prayer was always, God, I was agnostic, but I was like, if you do exist, let me know you.
Right.
I want, show me that you exist. Let me know how I can know that you exist. And he did. He answered that.
Yeah, he did.
And I think that's the mindset that you need to have. And if that's the mindset, if that's what you're asking for, that's akin to Solomon asking for
wisdom. That's akin to show me the way.
And accordingly, they turn their faces away from him because we despised him. What's interesting there is that even at that moment of would he be crucified or would the Romans find someone else to crucify? Who were they going to crucify? By the way, it was the Romans who was going to crucify, not the Jews. The Jews then are alleged through the Christian New Testament to say, they wanted to free Barnabas and crucify the other one, when they're yelling this, are they turning their faces from him? Mm-hmm. They're turning away from him? Yeah. Are they yelling at him?
They're yelling it directly to his face.
Right. Yeah. The people who have turned their faces away from him, from Yosha, from him being Torah observant, are Christians. They're the ones that turned away from him. So they can embrace their Dionysus God, their Tammuz God. They're the ones who've done. And we did not rationally consider his actual value. And, you know, I got a letter from Lisa. Lisa, I made a comment. I said, you know, I think we'll see Yosha, a possibility we see Yosha in eternity when we go down to 3D and Yahweh is with us in 3D. He might use that manifestation. She took umbrage with that and said, you know, she thinks that Yosha doesn't exist anymore, that Yosha is a Passover lamb, was conceived for singular purpose. That purpose has been accomplished. The Passover lamb no longer exists.
That's very compelling.
Yeah, and her comment.
Yahweh exists, and Yahweh can take a physical body, but yeah, it's definitely not the same body. And I guess in the sense of that soul.
Well, we have to be the main
from Sheol, so that soul would still exist, but yeah, the body that was Yahusha's gone.
Right. And she was. She also said that just as we have to be diminished to go from 7D to enter 3D when we wish to do so, so will Yahweh. So, but if you take the name as Yosha Yahweh saving, then the purpose for which he entered our world will always endure. Yeah, I would say so.
And Yahweh's Yahweh. He hasn't left anywhere. It was just a manifestation of him. So
it's nothing lost here.
Whether he shows up again or not, it's nothing lost.
That Yosha's purpose was to fulfill the promise of the Pesach lamb, and then his soul, Yahweh's soul, endure matzah. And as such, that job has been accomplished. And there's no need for, not even a Torah consistent ability for Yosha to continue to exist. Dod, who's the other limb of the tree of lives, Dod was conceived for a very different purpose, which was to manifest the nature of the father-son relationship that Yahweh envisioned in the covenant, and how you get into that relationship by being right, and you become right through study, through thoughtful analysis. And so, because the father and son relationship in the covenant is, by definition, ongoing and eternal, Dod lives. The Passover lamb is not. So that's it's an interesting thought. I'm not declaring that's certainty. There may be other passages which suggest otherwise, but it is an interesting perspective nonetheless.
Yeah.
Is there any? Oh, you wanted to also talk about we did not rationally consider his actual value, Jasab, because I think that really falls right into the essence of this message. That's the thing that when Christians have their God die, when they have him eating the Last Supper on Good Friday, and they have him die, and then they have him resurrected bodily on Easter Sunday, what they have done is substituted Babylonian lies for what he actually did. And if you don't know that he fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bechurim, if you don't understand why those had to be fulfilled, and if you don't accept the benefit that Yahweh is offering, therefore if you don't rationally consider his actual value, he is of no value. If you don't appreciate what he did on Matzah and how you capitalize on it, what he did is of absolutely no value to you. So all those people that claim to follow their Jesus and pray to their Jesus and worship their Jesus, he's of absolutely no value to you.
Can you just imagine for a moment how repugnant that is to Yahweh that they've used Babylonian myth and replacing with that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's worse than being an atheist.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything quite as repugnant to Yahweh as Paul creating a complete counterfeit version of the covenant and of what it means to engage in a relationship with him. I think that ultimately the single most repugnant thing that's ever happened in human history is Paul's 13 letters and how they became the basis of the religion of Christianity. But second onto that, I would agree with you that the imposition of pagan Babylonian rites, and this is a large degree done Paul anyway, Okay. He negated the entire value of Peace Act Boston, Bakotam, and the Chinook. Yeah. That it could be argued that they're one and the same. But yes, it's when Iowa made that kind of sacrifice, and the sacrifice is not only rejected, but a Babylonian
replaced with Talmud, Dionysus.
Yeah, it was pretty disgusting. It's one of the reasons why all of those who are victimized by Christianity ought to be extraordinarily glad that Yahweh is simply going to let their souls die. Mm-hmm. Because they are repulsive to Him. Yeah. All right, so, and then as we move on to the next statement, I think, Kirk, you had a word or two you wanted to highlight here. It says, nevertheless, our illness and affliction, He Himself lifted up and carried away, and our mental anguish He bore. And yet we ourselves devised a plot which considered Him reaching out bodily, then forced into being viciously beaten and killed by God for responding and answering the call to be afflicted. The two things we highlighted a week ago on that is that the ana is so essential to our understanding of the mikre, where we are being asked to answer and respond to Yahweh's invitation to meet with Him. And ana is used throughout them for that purpose. And while its primary meaning is to respond and answer, its secondary meaning is to be afflicted. Mm-hmm. And so if we respond and answer to the invitation, it's Yahweh accepting the affliction precludes us being afflicted. And so it's
so the absurdity of Yom Kippurim the other way is
right. Oh. Where they think that the most holy day on their calendar is to abase their souls, which is the exact opposite intent, not only that Yahweh has, but that any reasonable, rational God would want.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing here is that this specifically says that the plot that was so revolting is that the plot was considered God reaching out bodily. God doesn't have a body. Yahusha is not God reaching out bodily. It was the soul of Yahusha that mattered, and the role as the Pesach lamb. You know, when you start worshiping your God in the image of a man, you have a really puny God. That's a really pathetic God. In fact, that is a God created by men, but in the image of men.
Yeah. One last word in that group, just to, because I thought it was, personally, I just thought it so interesting that Kabbal is a Shemek and a Bet and a Lamb, SBL, pronounced, or it can be Kabbal or Sabal. I've seen it written both ways and phonetically. But if you're talking, if you're trying to connect the dots between this is Yahusha, the one not only that you would find in the witness writings where he's has a crown of thorns on him, but also, but more importantly, in the story with Abraham and his son, where the ram is trapped by the thorny bush, and it becomes the Pesach lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another little clue. He used pictographic language, of words, letters rather, and the first one in there is the Shemek, which is drawn as a thorny bush.
Yes.
I mean, how many clues, after a while you start to say, well, how many, what do you want, an engraved imitation and know that this is Yahweh? And,
yeah.
I mean, what do you want?
I mean, yes.
So it's just so revealing. Everywhere you look, you'll find that this is exactly what Yahweh was telling you. Isn't that hard?
This is the very word that links the story of Abraham and Yitzhak on Mount Moriah
mm-hmm.
with this
yeah.
passage.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and it is all about the intertwisted thorns. And the thorns, of course, represent two different things. I guess three different things. One is a thorn is piercing. you know, the thorn in Shaul's, Paul's side, messenger of Satan. That the piercing stinger of the scorpion that Yosha associates with Satan. So that's a piercing nature of it. The second is that the bush that the thorns grow on are twisted, interwoven. And that's the problem with Babel, with religion. It's interwoven and twisted lies.
It traps you, yeah.
Yeah. And the last is that, speaking of being trapped, that the thorn bush creates a barrier. That barrier can be the barrier around a community of those who know and love Yahweh, mm-hmm. keeping those who do not know him and love him at bay. Or it can be a barrier keeping those who do not know him out. It's a demarcation line.
Yeah, it's the separator. Mm-hmm. Separating to or separating away from. I wouldn't be surprised if we found out that in the garden, Dan was surrounded by a thorny bush.
Yeah. It could well have been. So this leads us to the first new passage for our program this evening. It says, almost all of us, the overwhelming preponderance of us, like sheep, have wandered away from the correct path. Each individual to his own way. And so Yahweh has interceded with him on behalf of all of our guilt as a result of being wrong. When, you know, this was obviously cold on it. And so it's typically rendered all of us. In the word coal doesn't always mean all. It means a preponderance. You know, all the earth. No, it's not the whole earth. Mm-hmm. But, you know, all the earth that was surrounding Israel, all the people in Israel, that sort of thing. When it says all the land, well, it's all the land that's in the area being discussed. All doesn't always just mean all, as in 100%. And so almost all of us would be a reasonable rendering of coal. But should you take the approach of all,
mm-hmm.
I don't think there's ever been anyone who started out on the right path but never wavered from the truth. I think it's 100% of people who at one time in their life had wandered away from the truth. Look at Moshe. Look at Abraham. Now, we don't know the earlier story of Noah, but we're certainly not presented with Noah being a perfect guy. Right? I mean, I was religious and political. I'm a poster child for this. You were an agnostic. Kirk, you were...
I had narrowed it down to whatever I thought Christianity could be true, and supported it with every dime I could get hold to. So, yeah.
And what's interesting to me is that if all paths lead to God, how would it be possible that almost all of us, like sheep, have wandered away from the correct path? Mm-hmm. They're all correct. Well, no, I guess they're not, are they?
No.
And this is singular. So there's one correct path. So this is the antithesis of all those who would say, all paths lead to God. No. Only one path that leads to God. Sheep is an interesting term here because sheep permeates this whole conversation. And so Yahweh is saying that the reference to the Pesach lamb and him being a represented by a lamb or sheep is that it is the kind of animal that typically follows. And so he became a sheep to lead sheep in the right direction, people in the right direction, but for the most part, most sheep have gone the wrong direction. We've gone away from that path, and we have turned to our own way. I've been meeting a lot more people, individuals, interesting people, these last few months,
mm-hmm.
and somehow the story of what I've learned comes up, And it is, it's always interesting to me that the overwhelming preponderance of people, and it may be somewhere between the overwhelming preponderance and 100% of people that I meet, when you really get down to it and you start questioning them, are you really open-minded? Are you open to learning? Are you willing to go where the truth leads, even when it leads to an unpopular place? Do you want to know the truth? And ultimately, what you find is, oh, yeah, until they will say, well, this is what God means to me. This is my view of God. Always. And I've never found an exception to that. I'm open-minded. Yeah, no, I'm not religious. Well, this is what God means to me. That's all I'm going to say. That's what it means to me. I don't care what you think, but that's what it means to me. I think Yahweh is right on the money here. Every individual has turned to his own way. Even within the popular religions, they aren't groupthink. Each individual has their own interpretation of them. And so it's not only that we have, as humankind, wandered away from the one correct path. Everybody's got their own variation, and they think that because that's what they believe, it somehow has merit. No, it doesn't have any merit. Meaningless.
It's like your opinion. You're entitled to it. I don't mean it's worth a while.
It's not worth anything.
Right.
Yeah, but it's worth it.
Now, this says that we have turned, so that Yahweh has interceded with him on our behalf. Now, for Yahweh to have interceded with him, that has Yahweh associated with him. It didn't say that Yahweh had him intercede. This is Ba-Hu. So Yahweh interceded with him. So that has Yahweh involved in the intercession, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Is there any way with Ba-Hu that you can distinguish, separate Yahweh from the intercession here?
No.
I don't think you can.
Oh.
And yet you have a religion of Christianity where there is no mention of Yahweh anywhere in the picture. Yahweh has interceded with him. Now, has interceded, will intercede. That's the nature of Hebrew. Verbs are true, past, present, and future. On behalf of all of us. And our guilt for having been wrong. That's probably my favorite statement thus far. The only one thing that matters. Are you right or are you wrong? If you're wrong, you need help. God's got to fix it. If you're right, doesn't matter how wrong you are or how bad you are. All that matters is, are you right? Look at Dode, is the perfect example. Dode had more bad than he had hairs on his head, and yet he was right. So God calls him his son and says that I am his father, that he is right. So ultimately, Yahweh's intercession with him only has value when we're right, and he had to intercede because we are wrong. Faith has nothing to do with it. Worship has nothing to do with it. Prayer has nothing to do with it. No religious institution has anything to do with it. God intervened because humanity was universally wrong. Humanity's universally wrong today. But it's about being right and wrong that matters. And Awan, you know, is inequity resulting in liability, perversity, depravity. That's a really yucky wrong.
Yes, it's twisted. About everything you said at the beginning.
I love to argue and debate with people, and have people going, well, you just never want to admit when you're wrong. Like, no, I just hate being wrong, so I want to make sure I'm right. And if I'm wrong, prove me wrong. I'm happy to admit when I'm wrong, but give me the proof. I hate being wrong. That's why I debate and I argue as much as I do, is if I'm wrong, I want someone to prove it to me.
Yeah.
There's nothing I hate more than being wrong.
Or demonstrate that I'm wrong. And I know I had one. I responded to an email today of somebody that found something in this chapter where I said that a certain word was based on a certain root. And and it's different than what Strong's has. And, you know, I travel so much, I don't have all my tools on my phone. And, you know, and my comment was, you know, Strong's is wrong a lot on the roots. And, you know, I've been wrong my share of the time, too. You may be right, and thank you if you're right for pointing this out to me. But let's say that I am wrong, which is a real possibility. I'm not besmirching this at all. I'm really glad the individual is looking his stuff up. I'm really glad this individual was thoughtful enough to say, you know, I come to a different conclusion on what the root is. But does it have any bearing on the truth that's being revealed? You know, we are absolutely wrong on many of our details. It's just the nature of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best we're going to be able to do. But are you right on the big picture? Do you understand what the covenant represents? Do you understand who Yahweh is? Do you understand what he's asking of us? Do you understand what he's offering us? Do you know how to capitalize upon it? Do you know what made Yosha special? What made Dode special? You understand the nature of Hebrew. So it's the big stuff. Now, I don't want to be wrong on the details either, and I may well have been wrong on that particular case, but the fact is that the key thing for all of us is to be cognizant of the overall message that Yahweh is conveying. And that's where all but 1 in a million people are wrong today.
Well,
you were going to say something about AWOL and about that it's a really an interesting form of perversity, of distortion, because it's based on twisting, isn't it, Kurt?
Yeah. Well, actually, what I was going to say, yeah, absolutely. All those things, I was just looking here on A1, and I've got twistedness, gross injustice, wickedness, punishment, and guilt. But the thing that was struck me as you were talking is in the same sentence, you've got to awe, and you've expanded on it correctly, have been deceived, led astray, mistaken, held incorrect beliefs, and intoxicated. I looked that one up, and I go through about 7 different lexicons, and you really need to on some of these words to get at it. And this is one I found just kind of, boy, very precise. And it's to awe is a word used to describe drunken men led astray by strong drink and or addicted to worshiping idols. That's about the most precise thing I could say about the awe.
You know, and that's the nature of Christianity.
Yeah.
The worship of idols.
Exactly.
Right. Of God on his feet.
I've actually heard someone use the term
jalapeno,
being in the church, being drunk in the spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah, drunk in the spirit.
Yeah, they do.
With their dead God on his deck. Yeah, it's pathetic.
If you look through enough of them, you'll probably find what you've got here. You may emphasize a little more of this rather than a little more of that, but I like JB, I like to get down and just write them all down and go, you know, probably all of them apply.
Yeah, typically most of them apply. Sometimes all of them apply, but almost always more than one simple definition applies.
Well, I think
you can't go wrong with including all of them in your translation so that people can decide for themselves.
Correct.
Well, JB,
you can never go wrong with giving choice.
You know, what I do is a tiny bit different than y'all. Y'all actually write, and I would say y'all are number one and two of English, Hebrew to English translators, hands down. Only thing I can do is I can look them up and I can make notes off to the side just so I can understand it, as well as just check it to make sure I'm getting the whole picture correctly and y'all getting the whole picture correctly. Not that you need me to correct you, but I'm just saying it's becomes very cumbersome to write what y'all do using all this stuff. But I like this format that we get to do on Friday nights where you can read such an extremely well-written translation with more than enough of expanded meanings of each word, and then we can play around and say and another thing and another thing and another thing and another thing, and then it opens up little doors to, oh, let's connect that dot. Maybe that's right, maybe it's not, but it is in the lexicons, and they usually prove to be true.
Yeah, I do think
that's part of the reason I've come to the same point as Craig, that I can't really just translate anymore. I have to comment on what I'm doing. And I learned so much from writing the commentary that my methods now become I'll translate a passage, then I'll write the commentary I do on it, and I adjust my translation as I go because I learned so much just from commenting on it. Because when I'm typing it out and I'm thinking through it, I'm realizing things that I missed before, so I change my translation. And so what I end up with at the final product versus what I originally translated can be two different things because I learned so much just commenting on it and thinking about it.
Yeah.
So I can't just translate anymore. I have to do that. It's part of my process.
That's the fun of it. You're transitioning between translating is knowing, commenting is understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding is vastly superior to knowing. Without knowing, there is no understanding. But to go from knowing to understanding is like a leap in dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
It's that powerful. Now, there's a lot of profound truth in this. He paid what was required. And he responded, answering the call to be afflicted. Yet, he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb, he was directed and delivered to the slaughter. Like a sheep facing her shears, is silenced. He did not open his mouth. Now, there's a lot of profound insights here. One is that we used to have a contributor that didn't turn out to be the best of people that did not understand why Yahweh had to do the whole Passover thing.
Mm-hmm.
And my point was always because he had to, because it was required. Because if he doesn't serve as the Pesach lamb, if he doesn't, soul does not go to matzah, then there is no way to justify our acceptance into his family, our renewal as perfect individuals, our transition from mortal to immortal. It would be capricious. So God created a plan that required him to do as he said. Not only does he have to fulfill his own promises and honor his own promises, therefore, he was required to do this. He came up with a means of being able to offer the benefits of the covenant in a way that they are now deserved because he paid the ransom. He paid the fine. And what he agreed to do is for those who answer the call to join him at his seven Moed Mikra, that he himself was afflicted. The next part of this was really troubling to me. It had just been troubling to me for decades. Even before I knew Yahweh, I was troubled by this. And he did not open his mouth. And I'm saying, oh, come on. They asked him questions at his trial. He opened his mouth. The Sermon on the Mount, the teaching on the Mount, man, that is opening his mouth. That's a long teaching session. And the Olivet Discourse, where he's quoting Zechariah, man, there's a lot of stuff going on there. He's yabbering away. He's basically citing the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, but he's having a lot to say. And then you go to the Pesach dinner. He's explaining his role. He calls out to his disciples. He explains who he is and what he's doing. People encounter him. He's talking to them. But even at his trial, in his defense, he's shown talking. He cites the opening lines of the 22nd Mizmor song. Yeah. So he's talking, right?
Mm-hmm. He had a lot
He's even talking when he's being investigated by Pontius Pilate. He's a talker.
Yeah.
So we opened his mouth. So what is this talking about? And when I wrote the chapter, I came up with, maybe this is dealing with the time in Sheol where he would be incorporeal. He wouldn't have a physical body, and therefore he couldn't open his mouth. And then and this is the place I have gone on this. And Maybe this is self-serving because this is going to share my view as I've studied Yahweh's testimony and tried to consider the Greek eyewitness accounts and the whole Greek approach to translating what he said versus what he actually said in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, is that we don't have a single word from him in the original language he spoke in. Mm-hmm. Not one. We have no credible early source of the so-called Christian New Testament. We got nothing. We don't have a Hebrew copy of Matanyahu that was originally written in Hebrew. We don't have a Hebrew copy of Yohanan. We've got nothing in the original language. And you have to ask yourself, why? Because Yosha was the word of Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't adding to the words. Yahweh already says, don't add to them. I've already got enough. Don't subtract to them, don't add from them. He is the word of Yahweh. He's not here to add to them. He's not here to change them. He's not here to, but I, Yosha, say, mm-hmm. like Paul did. There was nothing he needed to say. There was nothing that he said that we need to know. He's there representing the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Read the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and you know what the one who sent him, Yahweh, has to say. We aren't supposed to focus on the words of Yosha. We aren't supposed to focus on what he said. If we were, God sure as heck would have memorialized them in the original language and with a credible manuscript. And we've got nothing. I mean, literally nothing.
Yeah, but he couldn't do that because he already said the Torah is complete,
right.
Lacking nothing.
Right.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The first part of that sentence, you know, like a sheep facing her shears is silenced. You know, it's not that he didn't say anything. It's he was silenced. You know, his words were corrupted and removed. The first part informs the second part of the sentence, really.
Yeah, and even a sheep in front of the shears, I mean, it's a nervous,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, sheep aren't necessarily quiet.
No, they may be muzzled, but usually that ain't even the case.
Right.
But even then, like I said, you know, he was silent. He did speak, but his words were removed by man.
Yeah.
Man silent.
So your point is that
that he was silent.
Your point is that he didn't need to say anything. That all he was saying was what was in the Torah. So if he's not, so that's how it's understood.
Yeah, and according to JB, by misrepresenting what he said, by translating what he said into a pagan language, that his words were silenced. They were removed from
that's
us.
True too. Okay, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's a 1-2 punch. Absolutely.
But, you know, he really didn't do much to defend himself, by the way. Because the purpose wasn't to defend himself. He wasn't trying, and this is another aspect of it. He's not trying to get out of serving as the Passover lamb. He's there to be the Passover lamb. He can't defend himself and exonerate himself so that he's not convicted. He has already accepted as his main purpose to be convicted as
he wants us to understand why he is doing it.
Right. So he's already totally and completely committed to being the Pesach lamb. So the last thing he wanted to be was to be somehow exonerated so that he wouldn't serve as the Pesach lamb.
No.
The Pesach lamb can't go
for himself. Look how he jumped on Peter.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Shimon Kefesh. The Passover lamb does not commit suicide. The Passover lamb's life is taken by the family for the benefit of the family, and it nourishes the family. It does not commit suicide. Therefore, the life of the Passover lamb had to be taken for the benefit of the family. Therefore, he didn't defend himself. As you said, with Shimon Kefesh. Don't go to Jerusalem. Bad things are going to happen. You go to Jerusalem. Get behind us. Yeah, that's why I'm here. So it's lots of things I think we gain a lot by thinking about and And this happens to be one of... There's a subtlety here, by the way, that I wanted to share, too. The second mention of sheep is feminine. But it's not just feminine. It's a word for sheep that appears very seldom as a noun. It's usually a proper noun. Do you guys know what that word is?
That's
the second word for sheep in Yeshaya 53:7.
Rachel?
There you go.
Rachel.
Yeah,
Rachel.
Rachel. Rachel. Rachel. Rachel. Okay. Rachel. Yeah. You know of a woman named Rachel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can think of one. She was a little bit important.
Okay. Now, Rachel had how many sons?
Two.
Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right. Rachel had two sons. Who were those two sons?
It was Ben, and of course,
Ben,
his brother...
Joseph. All right. Who does Benjamin represent?
The wrong one.
Paul.
Yeah.
The wolf.
Yeah, Paul.
The wolf.
And Christianity, the wolf. The whole story, we did a whole program on this many years ago. The story of Joseph, from beginning to end, is a prophecy of Yosha. Every bit of it. Yeah, going into Egypt, coming out of Egypt, and all of the experiences that he has in Egypt. Every aspect of that story is prophetic of Yosha. And so, by using this uncommon word for sheep,
for you,
Rachel, what he's saying is that this is the dividing line here. This lamb is trying to highlight the difference between Yosef, which is symbolic of Yahusha, and Benjamin, who is symbolic of Shaul. So I think that's also a
pretty big, yeah,
delicious possibility.
It is.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Through oppressive intercession, and on account of the means to resolve disputes, misfot, he was led away on behalf of those who would live with him in future generations, who may give serious consideration to this situation, recognizing that truthfully, he ceased to exist and was separated from the material realm of the living. Because of the defiance and rebellion of my people, the assault upon the plague was directed at him. All right, lots of, again, there's a treasure trove of interesting things here. Oppressive intercession. Oster. Being restrained, enslaved, unable to conceive, withheld, detained, imprisoned. I only know of one prison where souls are oppressed. What's that?
Sheol.
That's what he's talking about here. Yosha was not oppressively incarcerated. I mean, he spent part of one night in the kind of walk-hewn holding cell. But that was for such a brief period of time. I guess maybe it even is designed to be a tangible example of what would happen with the soul in Sheol. But that is such a de minimis aspect of his life that I think what we're talking about here is the impressive incarceration. Sheol. Is the time his soul spent in Sheol. Now, this is next thing is that this one pleases me no end. Is I almost always translated mishpat, which is from the root shafat. Shafat is to judge, to exercise good judgment, to be discerning regarding the means to resolve disputes. So mishpat is to be discerning, to be discriminating, to understand the means to justify disputes. Well, and I've consistently said, that's the purpose of Pisac and Matzah.
Right.
So now he's saying through his oppressive incarnation, incarceration, I should say.
Incarceration, yeah.
Yeah, incarceration. But think about this for a moment. Pisac frees us from death to life. But it's Matzah that deals with the means to resolve the disputes.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Matzah that our souls are unleavened, that the fungus is of religion and politics is removed. And so the means to justify and resolve disputes is taken care of as a result of that oppressive incarceration on Matzah. And it's on Matzah that he was led away. He was not led away on Pisac. And led away is really important. Led away from whom? Yahweh. Led away from what? The land of the living. Where? Mm-hmm. To Sheol. The ultimate place of separation. This is a very vivid depiction of what was happening on the Shabbat of Matzah. And it's not consistent with what happened in Pesach. It's not consistent with the Christian Good Friday and the crucifixion. He wasn't led away on those things. He was put on a prominent roadway. And he wasn't led away on Easter. He came forth. So the very fact he's being led away, Christian, wake up. Where's he going? Well, the only time that his soul was led away and imprisoned was when he was in Sheol. And that makes it essential for fulfilling and enabling the means to justly resolve disputes. And why was he led away? On behalf of those who would live with him in future generations. Now, this is his door hue. Now, I have this translated in a way that suggests that my friend Lisa was wrong. That, you know, he'll be living with those in future generations. But it's more likely here that I put too much into door. And that the door should have been translated, he was led away on behalf of future generations.
Yeah.
And that they live with him doesn't need to be there. And the other is that if live with him is appropriate there, then it's the recognition that it was the soul of Yahweh who fulfilled Matzah. So it's the body of Yahusha that fulfills Pesach as the Passover lamb. It's the soul of Yahweh that fulfills Matzah. And therefore, it is the soul of Yahweh who will live with future generations. So if you recognize specifically what is happening to the identity, then my translation of Dor is correct. And it does not contradict Lisa's assessment.
No.
And
I'm going to say that soul still exists. It has to.
Right. That soul still exists. That's Yahweh's soul. So it's, in this particular case, you can either say I extrapolated too much, I wrote too much about Dor, and therefore was inferring that Lisa's assessment that Yosha no longer exists is invalid, and I don't think that's fair. Or you could say I correctly amplified Dor, for which you'd have to recognize this is specifically talking about what happened on Matzah, and what happened on Matzah was all about Yahweh's soul. I think either way you can justify it either way, and mm-hmm. both paint the same picture. Then it says that truthfully he ceased to exist in and was separated from the material realm of the living. This is so essential. How could he have been separated from the material realm of the living if his carcass was still in that tomb?
goodness.
He didn't just say he was separated from the living. This is the land. This is the material realm. This is Eretz of the living. If his body was still in that tomb, he could not have been separated from Eretz, the land. Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would have been directly there.
So the only way
that
you could have separation from the land of the living is he had to go to the place of the dead. What is the place of the dead?
Sheol again.
Sheol.
This is devastating for Christianity. If they only translated this correctly, thought about it, that their version of what happened of their God dying on a stick and then being put in a tomb and then bodily resurrecting, it is wholly inconsistent with Eretz Che. The idea that he was separated from Gazar, men, that he was cut off from, he was excluded from, severed from all association, losing all contact with Eretz Che, the material realm of the living. That
well, then
means,
you burn up the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I just said that means that whatever was of him, and we're still talking about the soul, because fulfilling matzah, it's gone. Even the body is gone.
The body's going to be gone, too, because it's burned up.
Right, the body is gone, and the soul is now in the realm of the dead,
mm-hmm.
fulfilling Sheol, fulfilling the promise of matzah in Sheol. But this is really, really important stuff. And again, a careful analysis of the words destroy the world's most popular religion. And why would you say, why is it so important for us to not just convey the truth about what Yahweh said, but also to underscore how everything that is being said here destroys a religion. Why not just live and let live? Tell you what you think is true and just stop.
Well, why go to a doctor to get rid of a plague?
That's exactly right.
It's a plague. It'll kill you. Right. My entire family is wiped out by this son of a gun.
Yes. It is a plague. And it's that plague that precludes people from knowing the truth. And if you can take... If you have the power to heal 2.5 billion people of a plague by pointing out the flaws and the antidote, ought you not do that?
Mm-hmm. You've
got 2.5 billion people
with a plague.
Absolutely. An ethical, moral obligation to try to present the antidote for that plague because it's killing us. That's why we expose it.
Well, there's also the teaching aspect of it. If you're going to celebrate these Moed Mikros, you need to have them in the context of what Yahweh was doing. So from both sides of the coin, it's still, you know, you need to know that when you're celebrating. It's, otherwise, you just walk through a, you know, you just eat some lamb and drink some wine and then,
And Kirk, we've talked about this so many times when people say, well, how should I celebrate these things?
Yeah.
By understanding.
Come to understand.
Number one.
Right. What does this say? We'll give serious consideration to this situation, recognizing that truthfully he ceased to exist, separated from the land.
That's one of my new favorite words. I love Sayak.
Sayak. Serious consideration.
That is a
honor
great
the information
word.
And implication. That's how you celebrate Pesach. That's how you celebrate Matzah. That's how you celebrate Pekodim and Shavuot. Yeah, Sayak. What a great
I
word.
I don't care what you physically do. If you do that, that's all that matters.
If you Sayak, you're going to be right.
Yeah.
And if you're right, then you're going to be part of God's eternal family. Yeah. Sayak is the antithesis of believing. Sayak is pondering the information and the implications and then speaking out regarding the thinking behind the narrative. As you mentioned a moment ago, JB, you can't translate without the commentary. I can't translate without the commentary.
Yeah.
Because once you are afforded these insights, you're just motivated to speak out regarding the thinking behind the narrative you've translated. Siach is the operative word behind all the things that collectively we have written and said. You know, it is. It's the operative term. behind everything that yada yada, introduction to God, questioning Paul, observations for our time, is the operative verb behind all of it. And he shows.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As I meet new people, I'm talking with them, I'll always say, it's one thing not to be overtly religious and political. That's a good start. But are you theoc? Are you serious about considering the situation? Are you willing to ponder the implications and the information that's available to us? And once you know it, this is the thing I think makes all the difference in the world. The difference between those who are parroting this and who come to know it and understand it. Once you come to know it and understand it, you're immediately about the business of sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Can't shut us up. By the way, this the verb gazar, it actually says that he ceased to exist.
Yeah, separate, cut off from. Yeah.
Yeah. But cease to exist, separated and cut off from. That speaks of what happened to the body of the Passover lamb. It was incinerated, ceased to exist. And then the soul was separated from. That's the whole Magdalene. There isn't a lot of difference between the way awon, which was that word of twisting and distorting and being wrong, is translated in the way that pesha is translated. But pesha is actually a very different word.
Mm-hmm.
With pesha, it speaks of defiance and rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
Religion is defiance and rebellion. Politics is defiance and rebellion. Being militaristic is defiance and rebellion. Agnosticism, atheism, defiance and rebellion. Communism, the religion of man, defiance and rebellion.
When you were describing
Pesach, absolutely, defiance and rebellion against God.
A few moments ago, when you were describing Mishpat, you said that the yeast that he was taking away from us was religion and politics.
Right.
So that's exactly, you know, it kind of.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't these little crummy things we do. That we're just because we're stupid,
right.
Or we're just not very good. Not well.
God obviously doesn't care about them. Enough, care that,
like
that. Dode did them, right?
He's trying to get rid of the stuff that said, don't bring into my house, and then you can come into my house, and that's religion and politics.
But no, rebellion is rebellion against Yahweh. Well, that's religion.
Yeah.
Defiance is reliance on man instead of God. That's politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These are offensive failures. They're defiant crimes. They're a contrarian nature, their trespasses, and errant steps of my people, my family. The assault upon the plague is directed towards him. That's just the realization that the only antidote for the plague of Christianity, the deadly pestilence of religion, is an understanding of who Yahweh is and what he has done as the peace offering, as the means to unyeast our souls, to take the fungus of religion and politics away on the market. That's what's being addressed. And it was all directed at him so that we would not be afflicted and he would be afflicted in our place. Really powerful, powerful things here.
Yes.
And they gave him over to the unrighteous, the Rasha, the wrong, the errant and wrong, in conjunction with the rock-hewn tomb associated with the termination of his biological life. And with rich people, he was elevated to the summit of his mouth. The Most High had engaged in nothing wrong or violent, and nothing deceitful was spoken by him. But, you know, that last part, if nothing deceitful was spoken by him, well, you know, then, Christian, you sure is better remove the book of Matthew from your Bible. Because if what he said on what's called the Sermon on the Mount, you know, through the first seven chapters of it, isn't deceitful, then your religion is hogwash.
Yeah. Either he's wrong or Paul's wrong. You can't have it both ways.
Yeah.
That's right.
If Christianity is right, then God was deceitful. If God was deceitful, Christianity can't be right. It's a lose-lose game for Christians.
That's
also interesting that, you know, in human history, might makes right. Throughout human history, the Most High were warmongers. Alexander the Great, right? Julius Caesar.
Certainly.
You know, Patton. They are Cyrus the Great, Ramses the Great, all the Genghis Khan, all of the great figures of history, for the most part, were warmongers. Might makes right. And what is the Most High saying? I didn't do anything wrong, didn't do anything violent. Nothing destructive, nothing deadly, no act of terrorism. Didn't even do anything really frightening. Then all of the history of serfdom and the feudal system under the auspices of Roman Catholicism throughout Europe, which were lords and priests and kings were elevated over the common people, and they plundered and looted everyone. Yeah, God says, I didn't do any of that. And it's also interesting that Chamath speaks of, has not demonstrated anything which would be involved with additional yeast. And thus he did not engage in religion or politics. But the Most High had nothing to do with yeast, religion and politics. And nothing deceitful was ever in his mouth. Now, to the degree that we'll take this first part, because you know, Christians love to say, well, you know, that was the two convicted criminals on the crosses next to him, and that, you know, he was buried in the rich man's tomb. So let's think about that. That they gave him over to the unrighteousness. They gave him over to the unrighteous in conjunction with the rock-hewn tomb associated with the termination of his biological life. No. That rock-hewn tomb was a rich man's tomb. And so the only way that he could have been given over to the unrighteous in conjunction with the termination of his biological life is Sheol. That's where he was associated with the unrighteous. But he most certainly wasn't associated with the unrighteous in that sepulcher on the top of Mount Moriah. And with rich people, he was elevated to the summit of the mountain.
Of his mountain.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the summit of his down. The Most High and engaged in nothing wrong. So, again, perspective is essential here. And it's not just that perspective, but you even look at when Yosha, Yahweh's soul, was reunited with the set-apart spirit on the book of Mormon. Where did he first appear?
Was that on the road, or is that to the apostles?
Oh, that was the second.
Oh, right at the garden.
And what is that? Where is that garden to?
It's
the summit of his mountain, isn't it? That's the summit of Mount Moriah, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, and who were the richest people on earth at that point?
Those who his family
who he was. Yeah. Those who didn't even recognize him there, but understood why he was here. Those were the richest people on earth.
Are you the gardener?
Yeah. And that's who met him, and that's where he was. He started his return back to the land of the living, right there at the summit of Mount Moriah, of his mountain.
Of course, you know, you just destroyed all the tour buses that are going to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
guess what?
Ruined a whole other industry there.
The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is the money in the world when I go to that hellhole.
So, you know, if you were wondering which one is true, the Garden Tomb, which is at the very summit of Mount Moriah, or the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which isn't on Mount Moriah.
That's the choice.
Based on this, which one would have to be accurate? Which one would you have to include? Which one would be included? Which one would be included?
His mountain.
Right. Of his mountain. Well, forget about the fact that his mountain is Moriah, which you really can't do. There's only one of them that was on a mountain, and the other one was not. And, of course, it was his mountain. That's a double whammy in favor of the Garden Tomb. Yeah, Moriah. So, for those who think that's where it was, that's where it happened, and that's where it happened. Now, the only thing that's important about it is that it fulfills the prophecy. You know, going there for any other reasons not particularly meaningful. I mean, I have been there. I've walked inside of it. It is kind of an interesting spot, I'll tell you that for sure. And so it was the will and purpose of Yahweh for him to suffer the effect of being crushed. He interceded by infecting him with the plague through the concession and condition of appointing his soul to suffer the punishment and serve as compensation. Where we go on. Once again, we have a vivid explanation of what was going on. Yahweh explaining, this is what I was doing and why I did it and why I wanted to do it. And we have an absolute refutation of Christianity. This is Yahweh's plan. This is why Yosha told Shimon Kephish, when he said, hey, don't go into Jerusalem. Let's not go there. Pretty bad things are going to happen there. He said, get behind me, Satan. I know that's what you want. But the reality is, this is why I am here. This is what I want to do. This is my purpose. Actually, it's Yahweh's purpose. The purpose of Yahweh to fulfill Pesach, Matzah, Makudim in this way. That's what Yahweh wants to do. Why would Yahweh want to suffer like that? Why would he want his soul to suffer? Why would he want his body of the Pesach lamb to suffer?
For us.
Yeah, because by doing this, he can redeem his children.
It's the price. It's the ransom.
Right. He can. He's sacrificing for his children. What loving fathers do. He's suffering the effect of being crushed. And I want to tell you that Pesach is a Passover lamb hurt, but it was nothing compared to the crushing of his soul and Sheol.
See, I think that's so telling that it does come out crushed. Everywhere you look, it comes out crushed. You cannot be crushed unless you're hard pressure down, reducing something down like a mortar and pestle that I use when I grind down paint for a temper. You crush it down to this tiny nothingness, which is an example of a black hole. That's a great one.
Because there is no point with the whipping or with the crucifixion that Yosha is crushed. Those are not crushing.
No.
They're impactful blows with the whip. But the whip does not crush. And crucifixion most certainly doesn't crush. And there is nothing Pesach about. There's no part of the crushing. No, excuse me. There's no part of the flesh-tearing hits of that whip that have anything to do with the Pesach lamb. The Pesach lamb is not whipped. And so this really has no purpose beyond the fact it just shows how perverted humankind is, how warped in particular all things Roman were and remain with Roman Catholicism. So this,
remember what
the Passion whipping
of the Christ,
yeah.
And
right, yeah, the whipping
that Christians had with that movie.
Right. Yeah, it's the whipping that exposes the rotten, vile, violent nature of Rome and therefore Roman Catholicism. But on the upright pole, he's pierced, but he's absolutely not crushed. So, for him to be crushed, you're right, Bert.
Sheol.
And Sheol is always presented like a black hole, a lightless place where time exists eternally and light itself cannot escape. Nothing can escape. Crushing pressure. And he interceded by infecting him with the plague. The plague of death is Pauline Christianity, first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
And so Yosha was infected with that terrible, deadly plague. That's what he took into Sheol. Through the confession and condition of appointing his soul to suffer the punishment and serve as compensation. Well, Christian, wake up. It wasn't his soul that suffered on your dead God on a stick, Good Friday. That was his body. And unless you know what happened to his soul on matzah, you're missing the whole picture. This is not about God dying. This is his soul dealing with matzah. This is his soul being crushed. This is his soul suffering the punishment. Well, the only way his soul can suffer the punishment is something had to happen on matzah. Because Pesach, the crucifixion, was all about the body. By just using the word nefesh there, he's completely negated any possibility of Christianity being meaningful, and now he's explaining Psalm 22, Mizmor 22, about what actually happened on this day. And he's explaining why God has a soul. It's his soul that did this for us. Pesach's wonderful, eternal life. But it's counterproductive unless you take advantage of what Yahweh's soul did for us on matzah.
Tell me when I tell them that I don't put any real stock in the Greek text anymore. Like, well, how do you know that God how do you know about the Messiah without that? Like,
yeah,
honestly, I have a better understanding of Yahusha and what he did from this right here, Psalm 22, and I have the perfect timing thanks to Daniel.
Yeah.
What do I need the Greek text for?
You don't.
I have a better understanding of the timing and what happened using the Torah, prophets, and writings than I do using anything in the Greek text.
Correct.
And you wouldn't even know that it didn't come from a virgin birth.
These are eyewitness accounts. Yes, these are really meaningful eyewitness accounts by people we can
this
trust
much
and rely
more
upon in the original language.
Mattaniah, Yohanan, Luke, or Peter, or any of them.
Right, all of them combined. Yeah, I was once asked, I've been asked that a bunch of times. Well, if you didn't have it, then how would you know he fulfilled it? Because fulfillment is all presented hundreds of years and sometimes thousands of years before it occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And those predictions are actually eyewitness accounts, and they're vivid.
Well, Yahweh kind of has a great track record for fulfilling his prophecies. So even if I didn't have these texts that tell me that he fulfilled this one, I can pretty much trust him that he did because he's built up enough credit with me.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's why the Greek texts are at best a historical document. They have some value as a historical document, but that's the extent of their value.
You know, and let's also keep in mind that contemporaneous writings can be used to help validate the predictions that Yahweh made. You know, for example, when we have the story of Assyria entrapping Jerusalem after having conquered Yisrael, and then you read in ancient writings from Assyria that this is exactly what happened.
Yeah. There
are so many examples that scream out from the pages of history that validate what we're reading here.
Yeah.
So the fact that you have an account
that interprets it the same way. Yeah.
Right. Matanyahu's account to dating to, you know, around, well, contemporaneous with Yoshi, even though it's now been translated, it's still a marvelous affirmation and history that it occurred. And you would expect these major events to have been recorded, and they were. But the history of their fulfillment.
It's not the word of God.
It's not the word of God. Correct. The history of their fulfillment simply validates that what Yahweh said is true.
It has a value as a historical document, the same as the writings of Tertullian or the writings of Origen or any of the historians who lived at that time.
Yeah,
it provides a value as a historical document.
I think Yosha's words brought out of Greek and back into Hebrew and then considered in the language that they were spoken, which isn't all that hard to do, by the way. You can look at every Greek word and say, okay, this is a translation of this Hebrew word. And you can get back into the mindset of what Yosha said in the language that he said it.
I think you have to have a better understanding of Hebrew to translate Greek back into Hebrew than you do to be able to translate Hebrew into English.
You really
have to know Hebrew in order to translate the Greek back into Hebrew.
Yes, you do. It's a much more challenging task. But fortunately, there is a tool that enables us to do it reasonably well, and that is the fact that the preponderance, in fact, I'm going to even say now conclusively, everything Yosha said is written somewhere in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Everything.
Oh, yeah.
And so all you have to do is reference where it's revealed in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and now you've got the Hebrew.
Look up the word again. Yeah.
The Hebrew, not translation, but the Hebrew proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that is that's essential. Then he will actually continue to look upon the offspring because he will prolong his days. The will and affairs of Yahweh through his hand will succeed and prosper. Now, the fact that he will prolong his days doesn't mean eternally. Does it? Just says he prolonged his days. All right. So the body that
you raised more,
the soul was taken to Sheol, and yet the soul was reunited with the spirit, and his days were prolonged, were they not?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that Yosha has to be eternal. And it's also saying that Yosha is the hand of God, which is exactly as we have always visioned him.
Right.
Yosha is Yahweh reaching out and down and out to us. Ellipticism.
Yeah, so many references to that. It's easy.
Mm-hmm. And that Yahweh's hand, through Yosha, has succeeded delivering prosperity, has accomplished the goal, which is for us to thrive. Advancing to the next level. This shalak is such an interesting word that Yahweh, through his hand, so this is Yahweh doing this now for us. This is Yahweh, through his hand, is accomplishing all of this. Will succeed and prosper, will accomplish the goal and thrive. Advancing to the next level. What's the next level? Fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
Fulfilling the promises of the covenant, of the Bereth. And all of this is the will and affair of Yahweh. You want to know the will of Yahweh? It's for him to accomplish this through his hand so that we might succeed and prosper. Well, this is such a beautiful depiction of what God did and why he did it.
Yeah.
And how he did it. And, you know, all the way through here, there's this, you know, Yahweh will do this with him. This is the hand of Yahweh doing this. That Yoshe is literally the will and desire of Yahweh manifest before our eyes. That it's Yahweh's soul that is accomplishing this. What you see here is the very definition of Yoshe's name, Yahweh saving us. There is very little distinction here all the way through between this hand of Yahweh, this Pesach lamb, and the creator of the universe. This Passover lamb is clearly a manifestation of Yahweh. This Passover lamb is clearly the hand of Yahweh. The Passover lamb is clearly the will and desire of Yahweh. There's no Trinity going on here. This is God doing what he promised, fulfilling the requirements he laid out for himself. And these promises most certainly aren't Christmas, Easter, Good Friday, the Last Supper, Communion. It's not what's happening here. This is Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkotim. That's what's being laid out before our eyes. So guys, this is really as rich and as deep, as powerful, as insightful as anything we could be pondering.
Mm-hmm. Totally agreed.
Yeah, so clearly laid out
this
for us.
That's why nobody preaches on this.
No, not an accurate translation of it, that's for sure. No one wants to think about it. You're not going to have any Christians that this is the hand of Yahweh.
No.
That Yahweh through his hand. Who's prospering? Who's succeeding? Yahweh. Through his hand, through his power, through his might.
No wonder they avoid this so much.
Yeah. I wonder what God's will for my life is. Well, this is what God's will is. That's what he says to Shephetz. This is the longing and desire of Yahweh.
Once
you're in the world, it's so easy. Mm-hmm. Is there any problem? Is it hard to find?
Yeah. Well, it
doesn't take a whole lot of
pretty much right on the page there. All you got to do is look up some words because we speak English, so you have to look them up. But other than that, it's not that hard. I was talking to somebody today, and the point being, if you get your head straight, I mean, we've talked about the Masoretic text and all being like about 85 to 90%, at least 85% correct. And if you understood that if you could throw out Adonai and Lord and a few things like that, you could get it down about 95% just by the things. And it's quite easy to get there. My guys, how many pages? What have you got, about 6,000 or 7,000 pages now just in Yada Yada? And you need to get your head on straight. If you don't need to prove that these concepts are correct, go there first. And then when you start translating and you go to something like the Masoretic text and go through, it's easy to fill in the gaps. There just aren't that many gaps. Most of them are religious input in the way they have to do it.
Right. Correct. You do have to correct the Masoretic text to pull it out of its vowel pointing. Pull it away from that because you do have to consider the definitions of words that are written the same way, just without the vowel pointing. So the diacritical marks of the Masoretic text have to be dealt with. You do have places, like this is a profound statement, that the Masoretic has a real tough time with. And so this is one of those places where there's more errors per word than any other place because it's dealing with truths that are so destructive to Judaism.
They really messed with it. They messed with Yashia more than any other section of the 12 prophets.
And so on. And then you also have to, and they really got caught on that because that's the most complete of the scrolls, so they really got caught with their underwear down. You do have to realize that something that you're not going to normally find in the Masoretic unless you're really a serious student, is that Hebrew is an internal language, that there is no past, present, or future tense in Hebrew. Because the Masoretic wants to ascribe tenses in time, and yet Hebrew has none.
Mm-hmm.
You do have to recognize that the Masoretic text by itself is not a particularly effective tool to ascribe the stems, the moods, and the conjugations, and that you really need to focus on those to have a more complete understanding.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are, you know, what I find is I think the last time I went through it and just made a side-by-side comparison, it's one word in 14. It's different between the Masoretic text and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And, you know, that's not huge.
Not a lot.
And that,
for a text this old,
that's right.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, we can blame Yehudim for lots of things. But one of the things you cannot blame them for is they were very diligent copy editors. They were mm-hmm. really, not editors, but copyists. They were the antithesis of the Greek Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were really good at it. And of course, you know,
part of it was they took it serious, whereas the Christians did not view the Greek text as, the quote-unquote early Christians didn't view it as the Word of God. They viewed it very much as just a historical document that, you know, if this says this and this says this, well, we can make them both say the same thing. They didn't have a problem with that because in their minds, they weren't messing with the Word of God. But the other part right. of it is, you know, while not necessarily literate, the Jewish societies were very well taught the Torah, you know, even through rote memorization. They may not be able to read, but they were taught it at a young age and throughout their entire life. So changing it was a very difficult thing. That's why the Masoretes used the vowel-pointing system to corrupt it as opposed to just outright changing the text. Because they knew if they just outright changed it, people would catch them on it because these people who may not be able to read still have memorized it because they were taught it throughout their entire life. You know, there was a huge focus in the Jewish community throughout time on learning and memorizing the Torah.
Yeah. And you know, part of it, too, is that the system of diacritical markings was devised expressly to make pronouncing Yahweh's name
mm-hmm.
impossible for anyone who was fooled by it. The first thing they did is deal with the vowels in Yahweh's name. And the second thing that's so interesting...
There are no vowels.
Yahweh's name is all vowels. But
there are no vowels.
Yeah. So that's the first thing is that the Masoretic approach was specifically designed to hide the ability to pronounce Yahweh's name. The second is that the rabbis that chose to name their system called it the Shoah system, and because the Wah has now, because of the diacritical markings and the nature of that system, is mispronounced as a V, so they call it the Sheba system. Shoa in Hebrew, the verb upon which it is based, means to corrupt, to twist, to mislead. And so they literally named the system misleading.
Corruption.
Yeah. Yeah,
and they pulled it off, and the most literate people in the world throughout all history are the Hudim.
Yeah, and yet they, you know, people will say, well, no one knows for sure how to pronounce the name, so out of respect for it, we're not going to pronounce it.
That's ridiculous.
That's just a lie that was perpetrated specifically under this Shoa or Sheba system.
Mm-hmm.
My children know my name. They shout it from the rooftops.
His children know his name. You're
part
of that
crowd.
You
know his name, Yahweh.
Yeah. And those who will survive and become part of Yahweh's family at the very end, they finally look upon the God who they have pierced and recognize that it is Yahweh. And they recognize he is Yahweh, and they shout at his name. And when Yahweh returns to his family, it's not just that he writes the Torah, places a copy of the Torah inside of us. He writes his name on our hearts. His name, Yahweh. So yeah, we love his name. His name is essential to who he is and what he's doing for us. In fact, his name embodies the very hand of God that was in this last passage. His name begins with the hand reaching out and down to us.
Great stuff.
Yes, great stuff. My voice is giving out, but I've enjoyed this immensely. We'll be back with you again this time next week.
Me too.
I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia today. Next week I'll be somewhere in Florida. So moving around a lot these days.
Your goal to do the show in all 50 states?
My goal is to do this show in all 50 states. Yeah, for those that don't know, and I haven't shared this with many people, Kirk, I know you know, but I'm in that nether world between separation and divorce. I just finally reached the point where I could not.
Sorry to hear that.
I'm delighted to tell you this. Except for the fact that it is a really, really unpleasant situation. But
sorry to hear that.
A lack of veracity is the reason that I just could not continue in the relationship. And it's beatingly worse. But the time that's invested in it and trying to restore relations and trying to minimize the damage, and of course, when you're in the middle of it, the one thing you just don't want to be anywhere near that person. It's just so aggravating. I read some of the texts that I have received, you know, in the last month, and it's just unbelievably contentious and demeaning, and so it is very wearisome. Sorry is not the word that I would use. No, yeah, it's not the word that I would use, because it's been one of the most liberating and affirming decisions I've ever made.
I knew it had to be tough for you to be able to, to feel as passionate as you do and then not be able to share that with your wife. I can't imagine that.
And never, not even any interest ever discussing it. Yeah, I've written now, 18 books, never read one of them.
I could never imagine how you were able to. I couldn't imagine not being able to share this with my wife. I can imagine how much that was a struggle for you in that regard.
Not pleasant, but anyway, that's why I've been.
Well, okay,
around.
Buddy, we're here for you. So
spending a lot of time doing things that are associated with that, and there's been other things on my plate as well, but that's that is the reality, and it is draining. I will tell you that it is a draining experience.
I bet.
So,
well, thank you for being here tonight. This is wonderful.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Good night, y'all.
Talk to you guys next week.
Good night.
Hello.